Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black explains to Graham Stewart how German states that were ravished by the 30 Years' War recovered to produce the cultural achievements of the Baroque Age.
Last week, we touched on the 30 Years' War, which was our major topic, and we discussed the intractability of the struggle politically and the intractability of it militarily. I think it's fair to say that from the perspective of modern wars in the 20th century, most people aren't used to the idea that a war ends often with a compromise. But in practical terms, if one side or other is unable to deal a knockout blow or to persuade the other side or intimidate the other side into a what we might call a total or complete surrender, then a compromise is going to happen. And I think it's fair to say that they had as much difficulty in accepting that in the 17th century as we might today in our very emotionally committed world, because, of course, the ideologies of the period, and we're thinking here of Catholicism of the Counter-Reformation and Protestantism, were not necessarily minded to regard compromise in a benign light. And on top of that, many lives had been lost, much treasure had been expended, many people had devoted many, many years to fighting. And from that context, there was both a sense that there ought to be something to show for it, and on top of that, that any compromise might be inadequate and insufficient. Now, you might argue that this is what, in a way, helps to produce the Peace of Westphalia of 1648. But as I pointed out last week, there were, in fact, short-term, if you like, moments, 1629, 1635 being the most obvious ones, in which, in fact, a peace seemed secured or very close. And therefore, from that point of view, rather than finding it necessary to explain 1648 as a complete surprise, as it were, it might be more pertinent as historians to think about why it lasted better than most of the pieces of the period. Even so, it is worth pointing out that it was not by any means a complete peace for the European struggles of the period. The war between France and Spain that had begun in 1635 continued to the Peace of the Pyrenees of 1659. The Portuguese Rising that had begun in 1640 continued to 1668, and so on and so forth in Eastern Europe. So in practical terms, the Peace of Westphalia is not a total peace. It's not a peace of the broader struggles that we would call maybe the European dimension of the 30 Years' War. It's more specifically a settlement of disputes within the empire, the Holy Roman Empire, and on top of that, a peace that brings particular bilateral conflicts, notably that between, let us say, Sweden and the Austrian Habsburgs, and between the Dutch and the Spanish Habsburgs, to an end. Now, what I want to do is briefly go through some of the clauses, and then we're going to switch over to a discussion mode. But if I could briefly go through some of the clauses and some of the ones that are pertinent, I think it's possibly best to take this in reverse order. The peace was subsequently to be recalled by protagonists of a stronger Reich, a stronger Germany of whatever form. It was subsequently to be recalled as it were, a disaster, a failure, a product of a weak Germany, one which allowed foreign powers to establish themselves. And there, the most obvious foreign power is Sweden, which gained much of Pomerania. It gained the ecclesiastical principalities of Bremen and Verden, and thus won control over the estuaries of the Elbe, the Oder, and the Weser, all of which could appear as a major limitation on Germany, whatever, however you define Germany. And that interpretation was to be given greater force by the extent to which, for Prussia, Sweden was an enemy both in the late 17th century. One can think, for example, of the great electors, victory at Fehrbellen over the Swedes in 1675. Then again in the early 18th century, where the Prussians make gains, and then again during the Seven Years' War. So that in some respects, if you were having a Prussian narrative of German national identity, then obviously you could present the 30 Years' War in those terms. I'm not sure that that's always a terribly helpful way to think about it, because in some respects, this represented the Swedish clauses of Westphalia, represented a neutralization of a Sweden whose forces had been able to advance into both Bavaria and to Bohemia, helping lead, for example, the Emperor Ferdinand III to terms. And therefore, in a sense, if you wish to use the term Sweden was bought off, it was bought off at a relatively modest cost. And you can take it further or look at it differently, that Sweden was one of the two external guarantors of the constitutional and political settlement of the Peace of Westphalia as far as the empire was concerned. The two guarantors were Sweden and France, and Sweden, as it were, was the Protestant guarantor. And from the perspective of confessionalism in that period, and the perspective of what had been an ascendant, advancing Habsburg Catholicism, most obviously in the late 1620s, but then again, for example, in the late 1630s, a Swedish presence in northern Germany was not necessarily a bad thing, we had to understand that, or unfortunate, and therefore we have to be wary of using a later and subsequent definition. Now, returning to Prussia, Prussia made significant gains in the peace settlement, including eastern Pomerania. That's the poorest bit of Pomerania, but it's still a large area, including the Prince Bishoprics of Halberstadt and Minden, and including the reversion to the Prince Archbishopric of Magdeburg, which they were to gain in 1680. So Prussia became, alongside Saxony, one of the two leading North German Protestant states. It made, in fact, even more substantial gains than Saxony had done. Now, again, you could present that either in a benign light, as Prussian commentators were apt subsequently to do, part of the rise of Prussia, etc., etc., or you can say this is part of a destabilization, in effect, of Protestant northern Germany, creating a strong opponent to Saxony, and that this is not a benign situation. You can play it either way. I mean, there are more elements to obviously complicate it in the sense that what the great elector was to do as ruler of Prussia included at times cooperate with France, which scarcely matched a, as it were, a Deutsch interpretation. Talking about France, of course, France gains much of Alsace. And from the perspective of later German commentators, this was thoroughly undesirable and became an element of instability and a factor calling for revanche. I think it's fair to say that that was a putting too much weight on one particular moment of what was a longer process of the French gain of control. And I would actually see the key year there as 1681, when the Louis XIV gained control of Strasbourg. We could go on through the individual states. I suppose the, you know, Bavaria taking the Upper Palatinate is really significant. But I think what was more important is that in many senses, the Westphalian settlement, and I do not mean this as either criticism or praiseworthy, maintained much of the existing situation. It's true that Calvinism was accepted as a permitted religion, but otherwise the 1555 Augsburg Agreement, in which the ruler could set the religion for his territory, was maintained. Rulers in the empire were allowed to ally among themselves to ensure their preservation and security, but not to ally for offensive purposes, and only on the condition that the alliances were not directed against the emperor, the empire, or the conditions of the treaty. Well, again, these sort of conventions were scarcely new, and they had been, it is fair to say, frequently broken. So again, I wouldn't say that there was anything particularly innovative. And also the point about external powers playing a role in imperial politics was not, or German politics, if you wish to use that term, was not novel either. So what I would say about the Westphalian settlement is it has an enormous weight placed upon it. Lots of IR theorists who know absolutely nothing about 17th century international relations and what in practice they amounted to will nevertheless talk about how it led to a new age of international relations, etc., etc. It has launched 1,000 lectures and many pages on that basis, but actually those are all rather flawed interpretations of a settlement which did not inaugurate a new age either in politics within the empire or in international relations. Over to you, Graham.
Well, I want to pick up Professor Black just where you left off there with that very point about the shorthand used of Westphalian Europe for the Europe of nation states and national diplomacy. I mean, it, flawed though it is nevertheless commonly used, particularly by international relations commentators rather than historians. But what is it that has led them to alight on Westphalia to develop this flawed view?
That's a very interesting thing. Where silly ideas come from is a very interesting question. Well, I think in part, Westphalia was seen by some commentators as the basis for ancien regime international relations. And those were then regarded as antiquated and redundant in light of the new energy and supposed, as it were, democratic nature of a different international relations that came in with the French Revolution. That, of course, is a silly view as well. But I think that's one of the elements of it. I think part of the element is that a lot of the IR theory likes the idea that Westphalia was a sort of an agreement of balance. It was an agreement of moving away from the supposed ideologies of the wars of religion, and that, as it were, it was a leap for rationality. And what a surprise, most IR theorists tend to see themselves as the progenitors and interpreters of rationality. But as I've said, it's very naive. And I mean, I have to say, you know, when I see a book on beginning on the Westphalia thing and then waxing eloquent about it, I always think this is foolish. And as you may know, I've written quite extensively on international relations in the late 17th century European international relations. And I've tried to show that there were marked continuities over this period, both domestically and in terms of the content, the context, and, if you like, the ideologies involved in international relations. And I haven't read anything that leads me to an opposite view, though I've seen all sorts of books that would try and argue that this was a new age and that there was a Westphalian set of values.
Are there historians who almost argue a different way, which is to say that before the Peace of Westphalia, actually, we put too much emphasis on the religious fight in the 30 Years' War, and actually there were good old-fashioned national dynastic reasons for the different state to be in conflict, and that should be more in the foreground than perhaps it is.
Well, I mean, certainly, as we discussed last time, there were struggles between those of a similar confession, similar religion, if you wish to use that term. So we've already mentioned France versus Spain, or France versus the Austrian Habsburgs. I think last time we mentioned how Saxony was one of the powers that joined with the Saxony, of course, Lutheran, joined with the Habsburgs against Bohemia at the outset of the war. There was subsequently conflict at some of the time between Saxony and Sweden, though at other times they were allies. So yes, but again, I think you know, it's always very difficult, and you might actually ask some of the rather foolish individuals to come forward and defend themselves why they say silly things. But I mean, what I would argue is that the notion that you have a simple clash between religion in period A and then not in period B is a kind of shorthand which tries to evade notions of complexity. I mean, to give you a good example for the modern world, you can think of the theory offered by another political scientist, Samuel P. Huntington, in his notion of a wars of civilization between different religions. And as I pointed out at the time, this notion of a lasting conflict between Christendom and Islam needed to really address the extent to which, for every 50-year period of Islamic history, more Muslims have been killed by other Muslims than by anybody else. And you could actually say the same thing as far as Christendom was concerned, however you wish to define it. Again, another thing, something we've talked about, the way, for example, people have a very crude approach to the horrors of slavery and the slave trade, seeing it as a form of white racism and ignoring the extent to which many slaves were slaves of fellow Africans and were traded by these fellow Africans to others, whether Europeans or Islamic slave traders or within Africa. So, but you know, that sort of element of complexity, which we can then take further, doesn't seem to appeal. But I would say the same problem occurs in the past when you're looking at religion. The people have a sort of either or approach. Either it is a war of religion or it isn't a war of religion. And, you know, there has been, as you may know, mathematical accounts almost of conflicts in order to show propensity in particular periods or particular contexts to wars which are held to be religious or economic, defensive or offensive, and so on. And some of the theoretical work on war by international relations specialists, you can think, there is good work as well as the rubbish. I mean, you can think, for example, of people like Jack Levy, or William Thompson, John Vasquez, all of whom have produced really quite sophisticated usage of historical material in order to probe political science theorization. But I'm afraid to say many others have not. And one of, in my way, my view of thinking, you know, and I have written a number of books on war, why wars happen and so on, is the rather glib classification or categorization of conflict. So if you're looking at the 30 Years' War obviously had at times a confessional dimension, but it also had non-confessional dimension. That should not surprise us. And nor is it beyond the ken of people to understand that if they look at more recent conflicts, where you can again find complexities in the dynamic of the sides that drew up and why those happened, why we ended up as a democracy allied to the Soviet Union, which was a tyranny in World War II, as opposed to another tyranny. You can actually you see the complexity of why these things happen and the contingent factor. That would probably, almost certainly would not have occurred had Germany not attacked the Soviet Union, because prior to that, the two were allied. So that in many senses, what happens is not necessarily the result of everybody who is involved making choices for that particular course to emerge.
Where does the period after the end of the 30 Years' War, where does this leave the Holy Roman, the concept of the Holy Roman Empire itself? There's an assumption that it's weakened, it's, you know, carries on until the Napoleonic Wars, but is it really a busted flush, or is it wrong to think of it in those terms, and actually it did still have significance?
No, well, I wouldn't see it as a busted flush. For example, the Christ, the imperial circles, which we discussed two sessions ago, a late 15th, early 16th century innovation, remained a way to focus regional interests. It remained a way to organize support for the defense of the empire against both France and the Turks in the late 17th century. And I think it's fair to say that in reaction to the 30 Years' War, there were strong efforts to make the imperial system work. And, you know, you saw some of this effort paying off, as, for example, the firm resistance to France in the Upper Rhineland in the mid-1670s and again in the early 18th century. I think the complication was, I mean, this is my own view, is that it's not so much that the Westphalian settlement was weak. It actually achieved its purposes, which was to bring the war to an end in the empire. It's not so much it was weak. It's that the imperial territories had, over the following 150 years, to face two differing challenges. I mean, there were other obvious other things as well, but these are what we're focusing on in power politics terms, two different challenges, which could pull them in different directions. Number one challenge is the challenge of relations with outside powers, France, up to the failure of the French in the Seven Years' War at Rossbach in 1757, Russia, from the 17-teens onwards, being the two principal ones. But on top of that, there is the situation, which had always been a challenge in the empire before, this isn't new after Westphalia, which is that some emperors could be seen by some princes as having, as it were, stances which they regarded as undesirable, either as autocratic or as expropriatory or as confessionally unwelcome. A whole host of reasons could be followed, but you see those arguments used at various times against Leopold I, against Joseph I, against Charles VI, and against Joseph II, and particularly against the last two. Particularly against Charles VI in the 1720s and against Joseph II in the 1780s, leading, for example, in the 1720s to a league, a Wittelsbach House Union, which then aligns with one or two of the Protestant rulers against the emperor. And then again in the 1780s, you have a similar sort of thing, a Fürstenbund, a sort of league of rulers, league of princes, against Joseph II. So there are tensions there, but you could again turn that on its head and say, well, come on, Jeremy, isn't that what you would expect? All political systems, apart from obviously Britain today, are, you know, peaceful, have nothing much going on, have clear confidence in leaders, you know, feel that the international situation is stable. We know that. I mean, it's only, you know, Britain that's saved from that awful course.
I wonder, I mean, it's sometimes...
I was reading from the editorial in The Critic.
It can be no more finer source material than that. But future historians will regard it as a key testimony of our times, I've no doubt. But returning to Germany, I mean, one of the things I struggle with is the concept of, you know, the 30 Years' War with its destruction. Did it Did it weaken Germany in the way that people sometimes talk about France being weakened by the First World War and the, you know, the decades that followed as almost like locust years? Or at the same time, but we see a Baroque Germany of great art, architecture, classical music, and so on. So, you know, there is a wealth and a cultural wealth there as well. So is it a mistake to think of Germany as exhausted?
Well, that's, again, an excellent question. I think one of the points in the 17th century which one needs to think about is it was a period as a whole in the world. The so-called Little Ice Age was at its apex. There was demographic stagnation. Cold weather affected crops and diets, caused hunger and poverty, and exacerbated the impact of disease. And at the moment, everybody's worried about global warming. Global cooling created, I would suggest, greater problem in that period. So there was that problem, irrespective of which particular war you're involved in. And if you read David Parrott's excellent recent book on France, in the Mazarin years, you know, this sort of period, or Gregory Hanlon's excellent book on 1636 in Italy, you will know that you don't have to be in Germany to have these problems. I think as far as the 30 Years' War itself is concerned, you have to distinguish between the actual devastation wrought by military action. So, for example, famously, the imperial forces storming the city of Magdeburg in 1631, for another famous episode, the eating of human flesh in Augsburg in 1635 during a siege. You've got, you know, and obviously there is devastation, there's killing and all the rest of it, but there's also the attendant pressures of the conflict. Now, you know, we are here in Britain affected by the attendant pressures of a conflict that we are not actually a combatant in, or a direct combatant in at the present moment, the one in Ukraine. And, you know, in the 30 Years' War, you have at the beginning of it, the so-called Kippurzeit, the widespread and very disruptive currency inflation. You have wartime taxation, which hits purchasing power, depressing demand, affecting trade and industry. And the uncertainties of the period also have a psychic consequence in greatly exacerbating already existing anxieties about witchcraft. So yes, you could argue, I think it's a important way to argue that the 30 Years' War has many serious consequences. But I think one would be naive to necessarily think that this was separate to the situation elsewhere in Europe. You mentioned the Baroque. Yes, I mean, the late 17th century in Germany, as I try and discuss in my book, I have a chapter, I think, called, you know, originally Baroque Germany. It's amazing how I think up these original titles. But, you know, if you look at that period, again, you know, there are strengths about of the situation, but many of the weaknesses stem not from the war, but from other factors. In economic terms, for example, low efficiency agriculture, in common with most of Europe. There was the very high level of particularism, protectionism, arising from the multiple nature of German statehood. There was the conservatism of the guild system. I mean, are we any different today with trade unions? You know, there's a whole host of issues and problems which don't necessarily take their origins from the 30 Years' War, mm-hmm. nor are they unique to Germany, though the consequences of having many states are a particular problem. But for example, internal tariff boundaries, customs boundaries, were also seen in, you know, in France, which didn't have the that situation.
Mm-hmm. Is there a very wide disparity in different states between the kind of the political and social culture that develops by the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century? Or would the life for a Bavarian be not particularly different to life for the average Saxon?
Well, I think, I mean, a lot of it was occupationally affected. I mean, if you were a involved in agriculture as a landless labourer, you know, it's going to be pretty grim, and you're going to be affected by what they call the rhythms of the seasons, with that somehow suggestion that they were benign. You know, you're going to have that situation. I mean, I quote in my book one of the British travellers of the period, a chap called Adam Walker, who was a rather perceptive traveller, and he's travelling near Fussen in southern Bavaria in 1787, and he's describing the women he sees in Bavaria in that area. And he writes, I sincerely pity them. They are such slaves as I have heard the Negroes in the West Indies described. No uncommon sight to see them threshing corn, driving wagons, hoeing turnips, mending the highways, by which he would have meant putting in stones to fill potholes. Now, you're going to have that same sort of situation if you're in Saxony or, you know, or East Friesland. So there are similarities, but there are also differences which stem from confessional factors. I think it's fair to say that on aggregate, reading literacy was higher in Protestant territories. There are differences which stem from whether you live in a town or whether you live in a rural area. There are differences between whether you serve a ruler who is very militaristic and may have conscription, as for example Hessen-Cassel or Prussia does, and be, you know, relatively eager to fight or to sell off soldiers for what we might call mercenaries, or whether you are, you know, you may be for a ruler like, say, the Margrave of Baden, who has a tiny army in the late 18th century. So a lot of it does depend upon, you know, contingencies as well as the similarities. But certainly the majority of the population, as in other parts of Europe, were economically vulnerable. They were day laborers, servants, paupers. They were an incessant feature of society, both rural and urban.
And at the beginning of the 18th century, would someone from southern Germany, his use of German would be sufficiently similar to someone, let's say, from
Hamburg,
that they'd understand each other? Or
no,
really,
it's rather, I mean, very heavily dialect. It would be very difficult. As with Italy or France or modern China, the written language provided a consistency that was not there in the spoken language, but only a minority of people, of course, were able to use the written language. So, no, there's grave differences, and much more great than what happens, you know, obviously, same in Britain. Factors over the last century, national radio broadcasts, people going away from home to university or for conscription, marriage outside the immediate environs, the impact of the motor car and before that the train in enhancing mobility, all of those diminished the contrasts between regions in the language, but they're still pretty marked at the present moment, and you would know that. But the extent to which people couldn't understand themselves was much more pronounced in the couldn't understand people who were subjects of the same ruler were much more pronounced in the past.
And in official documents and in universities, Latin was still the lingua franca, or various vernacular forms of German had taken over?
Well, there is a lot of Latin, but there is far more German, and German is much more consistent. Again, the same, as I said, as a written language, and the same was true in France and in Italy. I mean, a particular area that interests me and on which I've written is the history of diplomacy. And there, of course, the lingua franca for many, though not all, was French. So you shouldn't necessarily assume it's a choice, although it's a reasonable assumption, but you shouldn't necessarily assume it's a standoff between Latin and German. There were some German rulers who were quite pejorative or regarded German as a language which was not necessarily that of a great social eminence. But of course, again, that tends to change with the generations. It tends to change with the reputation that French, I mean, here we're talking outside diplomacy, but that French acquires with both the power of Louis XIV at the end of the 17th century and with the Enlightenment philosophe in the mid 18th century. But there are other languages. Italian had a lot of influence in Vienna, unsurprisingly so. There were Habsburg dominions in northern Italy, but also, for example, in Munich. There were Italianate circles in the courts of the Wittelsbachs there. So I think one has to be cautious before saying it's German or Latin. And I can certainly think that in terms of diplomacy, I mean, the periods I've worked on most intensively, which are the 17 teens, 20s and 30s, you can find diplomatic documents of German states in German, in French, and in Italian. So, you know, there's no essential consistency.
The great number of different states, did that tend to encourage a proliferation of universities and similar institutions, each state wanting to have their own universities? I mean, you know, this time England has got two universities and, of course, four universities in Scotland. But how lively should we see the level of intellectual debate and student life in the first half of the 18th century compared to perhaps elsewhere in Western Europe?
That's interesting. Well, there are a lot of universities and institutions of higher education. There are activities, particularly law, government and religion, which lend themselves to university education in this period. And as you say, there are many territorial rulers who want administrators. And on top of that, there are some individual universities that are regarded as very important in innovating or advancing particular ideas. The University of Halle, which was founded in 1694, was very important in developing a sort of what's referred to as pietism, which is a sort of political ideology of service as much as a particular nature of sort of revived Protestantism. So that's important in North Germany. Obviously, for Hanover, you've got Göttingen, again, important in changing Hanoverian service, territorial service, to be a more graduate-based activity. But I think it's fair to say that, I mean, it would be a mistake if you're looking at the 18th century to assume that the intellectuals necessarily went to university. I think, in fact, you could say most of the great thinkers of the 18th century, if they'd been to university, despised it. Edward Gibbon is a good example in Britain. Or they were operating in milieus where there either weren't universities, London, or where the university was pretty secondary to the major developments of innovative and prominent intellectual life, Paris being obviously the great example. The Enlightenment is not generally seen in its French or English dynamics as being a university-based activity. And I think one of the problems today is we're overly inclined to see intellectual life as a product of university academics. I think that was, I think that's very questionable today, but I think it's particularly questionable for the 18th century.
Well, that's maybe a fruitful subject for another time to talk further, but we'll have to call it a day there for Germany in the 70 or 80 years after the 30 Years' War. Professor Jeremy Black, who's A Brief History of Germany, is published in paperback now. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.